Well, brethren, if I were to ask any of you to kind of sum up, in a sentence or maybe in a word, the very nature and character of God, how would you answer that question? If you think of how to kind of sum up God's character, the very character that we're all striving to develop in our own lives, how would you describe that? I'm willing to bet that if I were to ask that question, most of you out here hearing this would have a one-word answer for that. And in fact, you'd probably turn to the same scripture we're going to turn to here in a minute in 1 John 4, and you'd read right off the page where it says, God is love. In fact, that's probably not just the answer that most Church of God members would give. If you ask the average professing Christian, they'd probably also give you the exact same answer. However, if you ask to kind of operationalize that, in other words, what does that look like? You kind of put that into practice. Oftentimes, you'd find people have, their definition of that. It's kind of different than what the Bible actually describes if we look at it in detail. And the reason I mention that is because the way we use the word love in the English language, if you just think about it, we talk about loving someone or being in love with someone, or so sometimes we may talk about a particular hobby that we just love to do. We really enjoy doing this particular thing, or we might talk about a vacation spot that we just really enjoy going to. And I just love going to that place. I just have so much fun when I go there. And if you think about the commonality in all of these ways that we use the term love, we normally use it, in regards to things that give us very positive feelings. That gives us positive emotions, makes us experience joy in our lives. Those are the things that we associate with love. And things that might cause us pain or displeasure, make life difficult and painful, we typically don't associate that with love because we oftentimes, again, think of love in terms of positive emotions. But what we're going to see today is if we look at how the Bible defines love, in fact, the primary example it gives to demonstrate God's love, it's not defined in terms of positive emotions. So let's take a deeper look at this subject today to understand, the very nature and character of God, and again, the very nature and character that we're supposed to be developing in our own lives. Because again, to understand not only God's nature, but again, to correctly understand how He's worked with mankind in the past, how He works with us today, and how He'll work with mankind in the future, it's very pivotal that we have an accurate biblical definition of love and not one that we've gotten from our own human reasoning or our own human emotions. So if you'd like a title for this sermon, it's Godly Love is Not an Emotion. Again, Godly Love is Not an Emotion. Because as I mentioned, as carnal human beings, we typically tend to define the subject of love in terms of positive emotions. Things that make us feel happy, make us feel good and joyful. Again, that's typically our association with it. What we're going to see today is that's not really how the Bible defines it. Now, to start off with, turn over to 1 John chapter 4. Again, 1 John chapter 4. As I'm sure when I asked the question, how would you sum up the very character of God, this is probably the verse that came immediately to your mind. It's 1 John chapter 4 in verse 7. It says, "Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God, and everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. He who does not love does not know God, for God is love." Again, that's straight out of the Bible. It tells us basically to sum up the very character and nature of God. The word love, or as it is in Greek, agape, basically the spiritual form of love, is how God's character is defined. It defines his very existence. But now let's notice what it gives us as the chief example of that love. Because if we're going to dig into this in detail in the beginning of the sermon here, to see that this kind of defies our association with love always being associated with positive, happy, good times. Now notice, can continue on here in verse 9. In this, the love of God was manifested toward us, that God has sent His only begotten Son into the world that we might live through Him. In this is love, not that we loved God, but that He loved us and sent His Son to be the propitiation for our sins. Beloved, if God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. I notice it's giving us the chief example of God's love, the fact that He sent Christ to die for the sins of mankind. Now, it's easy to see, if you look at this from a long-term outcome perspective, why this is such a good thing. But what I want you to understand as we go through this sermon is, again, this difference between how something feels, you know, how it's experienced, you might say, on the front end when it's initially happening versus the long-term outcome. Because we're going to see that godly love is defined by the long-term outcome. Or as if you've listened to a lot of my sermons over the years, I love to sum it up like this. I say, you know, godly love is not defined by the question, does it feel good? It's defined by the question, does it do good? Because as we're going to see here, there's lots of things that, you know, God defines as love that don't feel good on the front end. They're not there. They don't seem positive and warm and fuzzy and happy on the front end. It's the long-term outcome that results in it being love, because the long-term outcome is a positive thing. Now, to see this mentioned again, turn over to John 3. It's a very common scripture here, John 3:16. Now, this is going back several decades ago, but I know probably in the early 90s, it was common, if you even watched, you know, major sporting events on TV and such, you know, like the Super Bowl or World Series or things of that nature, you'd oftentimes see, you know, shots of the crowd, you know, and there'd be someone in the crowd holding up a sign that said John 3:16. You know, that God loved the world, you know, and oftentimes you'll see, even in the Protestant world and such, when they talk about God or they talk about Christ, you know, because they believe in the Trinity and they kind of meld them together. But they're always talking about, well, God loves you, God loves you. And that's true. But again, they're always focused on, again, this kind of warm, fuzzy definition of love. But let's notice here in verse 16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever perishes in him should not, whoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. Notice again, the chief example of God's love, you know, kind of the pinnacle example, is that he gave Christ to be the sacrifice for mankind. Now, again, let's think this through kind of on both sides of the equation. Because what I want you to see is, again, the contrast between what it looks like on the front end and what it looks in the long-term outcome, because they're very different. Because what you've got here, you know, if you look at this, you know, there's basically two parties involved here. You've got God the Father and then Jesus Christ as well being addressed here. But let's look at it from both of their perspectives. Now, for God the Father, he is giving his Son, you know, to basically be falsely arrested, you know, taken captive, tortured, and brutally murdered. You know, it's an utterly painful, ugly experience. Now, think of that from the perspective of, you know, a human parent. That's something, you know, us as physical human beings can relate to. Oftentimes it's said that one of the most painful things a person can go through is the death of one of their children. Because, you know, most everybody at some point experiences the death of their parents, you know, because that's kind of the normal course of life. You know, children typically outlive their parents, just because kind of the normal cycle of life. And that can be a very painful thing for, you know, a person to lose their parents. But again, that's kind of the normal expectation. You know, but sometimes it happens the other way around. And that is particularly brutally painful for a parent to lose their child, you know, or to watch their child go through, you know, some gruelingly hard trial of a health problem or, you know, some type of painful situation they're going through. You'll oftentimes hear a parent in that situation express the desire that, you know, if only I could take it on myself, you know, and I could spare my child from having to go through this. You know, it could be me suffering this and my child could be protected. Because it's a very, very painful thing for a parent to watch their child go through this. And again, if we focus on what's taking place here on the front end, that's what this looks like. That's what this looks like for God the Father. Now, to understand what it was like for Christ, we can read his own account of what took place. Turn over to Matthew 26. It's Matthew 26. We're going to read here kind of the account that takes place right after, you know, after Christ has already had, you know, the final Passover service with his apostles, you know, and it's kind of in between that and when he's actually arrested and taken prisoner. We'll pick up in verse 36. It says, then Jesus came with them to a place called Gethsemane and said to the disciples, sit here while I go and pray over there. And he took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, and he began to be sorrowful and deeply distressed. And notice this is gruelingly painful for him, because he's very familiar with what the book of Isaiah prophesies about what's about to happen to him. This is not a surprise to him about what he's about to go through. He knows in graphic detail what he's about to face. And that's, this explains the stress he's going through. In verse 38, then he said to him, my soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch with me. And he went a little further and fell on his face and prayed, saying, oh, my father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. He's begging for a plan B. In other words, is there some other way to accomplish this purpose and I don't have to go through this gruelingly ugly experience? Because I am not looking forward to this. You know, look up and pick up in verse 40. Then he came to the disciples and found them asleep and said to Peter, what, could you not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. The spirit is indeed willing, but the flesh is weak. And he went away again a second time and prayed, saying, oh, my father, if this cup cannot pass away from me unless I drink it, your will be done. And he came and found them asleep again, for their eyes were heavy. So he left them and went away again and prayed the third time, saying the same words. And then he came to the disciples and said to them, are you still sleeping and resting? Behold, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, he who betrays me is at hand. See, he knows in graphic detail what he's about to go through, and he is not looking forward to this. He is dreading this. He is pleading for a plan B. Because what I want you to see here is, again, on all sides of the equation, you know, the Father is, you know, is giving the sacrifice. Christ is the sacrifice. But both parties involved, this is an ugly, brutal, painful experience to go through. You know, it's not something we typically associate with love. It's not something that's warm and fuzzy and makes us happy and gives us a good day. No, this is like a nightmare experience everyone wants to avoid. But now let's understand again, why is this considered love? Turn back over to John 3, where we started. We're going to read again verse 16, but then we're going to see verse 17, which explains to us again why this is such a wonderful act of love. Because so far it just looks like a brutally ugly experience that no one would want to go through. In verse 16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. I notice verse 17. For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. Because see, if you look at the long-term outcome, it's a totally different picture. Because Christ being willing to go through this, you know, because we saw in his own words, it's like, man, if there's no other way around this, I'll bite the bullet and I'll do it because I know it's for the ultimate good, but man, I don't want to do this. You know, well, he knew in the long term, he was going to be the sacrifice that enabled salvation to be offered to all of mankind. A massive good is accomplished from this. In fact, both parties that were going through this very ugly experience also win in this as well, because Christ gets a wife out of the deal. Because we know what, he winds up ultimately marrying the church. You know, that's described for us in Revelation 19. We become the bride of Christ. And then, you know, in the first verse, get to marry him. You know, so he gains, you know, basically a wife out of the deal. The Father expands his family, you know, and able to share, you know, all of his plan with all of those mankind who are willing to overcome and make it into his kingdom. There's huge benefits that come out of this. But again, keep in mind, it wasn't how it felt when it was happening. It wasn't that it was warm and fuzzy on the front end. It did good. It ultimately ended well. And that's the key to understanding the love of God. And we're going to see examples not only historically, looking at how God worked with ancient Israel in the past. We're going to look at how he works with us today and how he'll work with mankind in the future. And again, the key to properly understanding all of this is, again, the biblical definition of love. Because it's not about, does it feel good? It's not, does it give us warm, fuzzy, happy, positive feelings? No, it's what is the ultimate outcome? Because we'll start off again looking, you know, historically. Because if you know, one of the things that people really have can struggle with in understanding God. In fact, you'll oftentimes hear, particularly in the Protestant world, they go, man, that God in the Old Testament, he's just brutal and mean. And they just see him as cruel. And again, this has nothing to do with the Church of God debate as to who is the God of the Old Testament and whether that was, God the Father that's dealt with mankind or Christ. That's really not the issue, because again, in their view, it's a Trinitarian, all kind of a blob together. But they look at this and they just struggle with that God in the Old Testament. He's just this mean and cruel, awful individual. But oh, Jesus is love and kindness and all this. And they can't understand this. Well, one of the reasons why is because the whole picture of the instructions that Israel was given when they conquered the Promised Land. Because they literally go into these cities and they're given the instruction of just wipe everything out. Basically, just exterminate, kill everything that breathes, and can thoroughly wipe out everything that's there. Well, this is just a very brutal, difficult thing to look at. But again, to understand the full perspective, again, we've got to look at it from a bigger picture, might say, of a long-term perspective of it all. Because first, we have to understand just how evil the people were that God was basically driving out of the land and telling the Israelites to wipe out. Because it's important to understand that. Because oftentimes it sometimes gets, characterized like, oh, it was just this different culture and they had different beliefs and they were living in harmony with themselves and with the land and, kind of this, fairy tale picture of it. And these evil Israelites just came in and pushed them around and wiped them out. Well, that's not the picture that the Bible paints. Turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 18. We're just going to look at a couple of scriptures here to get, first of all, an accurate picture of kind of what the culture of these people was like and why God would do something, as brutal as tell the Israelites to just wipe this culture out entirely. I turn to Deuteronomy chapter 18. We'll start reading in verse 9. Because we want to kind of understand here kind of a synopsis of what this culture was like of, the people in the land of Canaan. And when you come into the land which Jehovah your God is giving you, you shall not learn and follow the abominations of those nations. Now let's get an idea what some of those abominations are. There shall not be found among you anyone who makes his son or daughter pass through the fire. Now, what he's referring to here, and we'll read this again in a minute in Leviticus 18, is child sacrifice to the pagan god Molech. It was a common practice at the time that they would take infant children and toss them into a hot fire, as a religious sacrifice to their pagan god Molech. So they're basically brutally murdering children, is what we're seeing here. This is a common practice of their culture. Now, continuing on in verse 10. Or who practices witchcraft, or a soothsayer, or one who interprets omens, or a sorcerer. In other words, this is a very demonic culture. This is a kind of a demon-worshipping, very, very demonically influenced culture that we're talking about here. We're not just talking about just, your basic, carnal, misguided people. These are people just very bent on evil. In verse 11, or one who conjures spells, or a medium, or a spiritist, or one who calls up the dead. For all who do these things are an abomination to Jehovah, and because of these abominations, Jehovah your God drives them out from before you. You shall be blameless before Jehovah your God. For those nations which you will dispossess, listen to soothsayers and diviners, but as for you, Jehovah your God has not appointed such for you. Because, see, he's wiping them out because of, again, their evil practices, but he also doesn't want them to be a source of contamination, to the Israelites, because he knew that's what would happen. That would be the long-term effect if they didn't wipe them out. Now, to get a little more detail on this, turn over to Leviticus chapter 18. Now, we're going to start reading in verse 21, but I'm just going to kind of summarize the first half of the chapter here. If you've got a New King James translation like myself, New King James typically has subheadings that are added throughout the Bible. And at the beginning of chapter 18, it has a subheading, Laws of Sexual Morality. Because you can see that's the primary focus of chapter 18. And most of the first half of the chapter kind of goes into basically describing incest from every possible combination, you know, that you can have it. Now, not only was this a very incestuous culture, but you can easily see if you have incest at this level, because again, it covers basically, you know, every combination of incest that you could have. And we'll see when we read the latter part of the chapter, he directly says, you know, all of these things, you know, the people that you're going to dispossess, they engage in all of this. In other words, this is their common practice. You know, so not only are they a child murdering, you know, culture that throws their babies, you know, in the fire to Molech, they're a child molesting, you know, culture as well. When you have that level of incest, you can obviously assume you've got lots of, you know, underage sex abuse going on as well. You know, it's a very perverted culture. And as we're about to read here, again, another reference again to Molech, where we're going to read, you know, about bestiality. I mean, this was a very, very perverted society. You know, now pick up in verse 21. And you shall not let any of your descendants pass through the fire to Molech, nor shall you profane the name of your God. I am Jehovah. Again, this is another reference, again, to child sacrifice, you know, which was taking infant children and burning them alive, you know, just throwing them into a furnace of fire as a religious sacrifice. In verse 22, and you shall not lie with a male as with a woman, it is an abomination. In other words, homosexuality and lesbianism was, you know, was a very common, the whole gender confusion, you know, was a very common thing in their culture. In verse 23, nor shall you mate with any beast to defile yourself with it, nor shall any woman stand before a beast to mate with it. It is perversion. In other words, bestiality. They had commonly had sex with animals. I mean, these people have no boundaries and no sense of normalcy whatsoever. In verse 24, do not defile yourselves with any of these things, for by all these the nations are defiled, which I am casting out before you. So that directly tells you all the different, you know, types of incest and other issues that are covered in the first part of the chapter. He's saying, they do all of this, you know. I'm not just listing this just to be thorough. You know, this is common practice among these people. In verse 25, for the land is defiled, therefore I visit the punishment of its iniquity upon it, and the land vomits out its inhabitants. You shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments, and shall not commit any of these abominations, either any of your own nation or any stranger who sojourns among you. For all these abominations the men of the land have done, who were before you, and thus the land is defiled, lest the land vomit you out also when you defile it, as it is vomited out the nations that were before you. For whoever commits any of these abominations, the persons who commit them shall not get cut off from among, shall be cut off from among their people. Therefore, you shall keep my ordinances so that you do not commit any of these abominable customs which were committed before you, and that you do not defile yourselves by them. I am Jehovah your God. So you can see, I mean, just this was not just your regular carnal people who just don't really understand the right ways and don't know when the Sabbath is, and maybe they keep Christmas and Easter, and, you know, they're misguided in some ways, but the good-hearted people, that's not who he was wiping out. You know, this was a people who were just evil in every way you can imagine. They were demon worshipers, they were child sacrificers, they were child molesters, they were just rotten to the core. So see, he was wiping them out for their own good. Because first of all, if you just look at it, you know, from the society of these people, you know, think about a culture that is that bent on evil, you know, that is evil in everything that they do. What are they doing? They're indoctrinating their children, you know, generation after generation, you know, basically, you know, visiting the sins of the fathers upon the third and fourth generation. That's what was happening. You know, so they were just basically an indoctrination center to create more and more people that were this warped and twisted. You know, but the other problem was, remember, God had a great plan, you know, for Israel when he sent them into the promised land. He was not only wanting to bless them as the descendants of Abraham, he wanted them to be a model nation, to be an example to the rest of the world. You know, he ideally was looking for other nations to be able to look at them and go, wow, those folks are doing something right. You know, we need to go find out what they're doing right and why things go so well for them. you know, and want them to inquire, who's the God of Israel? Because sure is treating you guys right. You know, maybe we should worship him too. You know, that was the objective. But he knew if they stayed in an environment with these kind of people, that the clock was ticking on that being destroyed is what was eventually going to happen. And see, this is what he warns them for in Deuteronomy chapter 7. Deuteronomy chapter 7, and we'll start reading in verse 1. It says, when Jehovah your God brings you into the land which you go to possess and has cast out many nations before you, the Hittites and the Girgashites and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than you. And when Jehovah your God delivers them over to you, you shall conquer them and utterly destroy them. In other words, completely wipe them out. And you're going to see as we continue on here, he's saying, you know, don't try to make friends with them. Don't intermarry with them. Don't make covenants with them. In other words, don't think, oh, this is the nice approach or where we're going to be nice and kind. And you go, no, just wipe them out and get that, you know, environment away from you because it's poisonous. In verse 3, nor shall you make marriages with them. You know, okay, let me pick up in verse 2 again. And when Jehovah your God delivers them over to you, you shall conquer them and utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them, nor show mercy to them. In other words, don't think, well, we're going to do the nice and loving thing with them. He said, no, the loving thing in this case is I want you to wipe them out. And in verse 3, nor shall you make marriages with them. You shall not give your daughter to their son, nor take their daughter to your son. For they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods, so the anger of Jehovah will be aroused against you and destroy you suddenly. See, that's the reason why, because he's looking at the long-term outcome. In verse 5, but thus you shall deal with them. You shall destroy their altars, break down their sacred pillars, cut down their wooden images, and burn their carved images with fire. In other words, wipe out their whole culture. Don't take any of it, because it's poison. In verse 6, for you are a holy people to Jehovah your God, and Jehovah your God has chosen you to be a people for himself, a special treasure above all the peoples of the face of the earth. Jehovah did not set his love on you, nor choose you because you were more in number than any of the other people, for you were the least of all the people. But because Jehovah loves you, and because he would keep the oath which he swore to your fathers, Jehovah has brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of bondage, from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Therefore, know that Jehovah your God, he is God, the faithful God, who keeps covenant and mercy for a thousand generations for those who love him and keep his commandments. And he repays those who hate him to their face to destroy them. And he will not be slack with him who hates him, and he will repay him to his face. Therefore you shall keep the commandments, statutes, and judgments, which I command to you to observe them. Notice he's directly saying he's merciful and loving, but he's also just with those who are just bent on evil. And that's what he's dishing out here. You know, he's dishing out justice to those who were just bent on evil, who worship demons, who burn their children in fire, who molest their children, you know, who have sex with animals. I mean, they're just evil in every way possible. And he's saying, okay, they're getting their just results for this. You know, they're getting the rewards for their behavior. But he also understands, again, what a negative influence this would be upon the Israelites. Because what do we know from the history of ancient Israel of what actually happened? Well, they didn't follow all these instructions. They didn't wipe all of them out, you know, because they got parsley there and thought, well, you know, we should be nice to the people. We should work with them and coexist with them. And so they decided to do kind of the carnal definition of love and being a nice guy. And how did it turn out? They wound up intermarrying with the people, and it turned out just like this chapter describes. They started worshiping their gods, taking upon their practices, you know, and what happened? It perverted the culture of Israel, you know, and eventually they totally turned away from God, you know, had to go into captivity numerous times, and eventually just got carried off out of the land, because it totally turned their hearts against them. So see, when God gave these instructions, again, it wasn't because it was warm and fuzzy and positive and gave everybody warm, fuzzy emotions on the front end. He's like, no, it's pretty ugly on the front end. It's pretty brutal. He's looking at the long-term outcome of how it would turn out. And if they didn't follow these instructions, it would be disastrous to the whole plan. And eventually it was, because they didn't follow all the instructions and it turned out badly, just like he said it would. What we've seen here from this example is oftentimes, again, the biblical definition of love, can be things that don't feel real good on the front end, but it's loving and it's a positive thing because of the long-term outcome. Well, it's important to understand the opposite can be true as well. And what I mean by that is there are things we can do because it feels good on the front end, because it seems like the loving, nice thing to do on the front end, but in the end, it's a catastrophic disaster. And again, it's illustrating the same point of where you always need to look at the long-term outcome. Now, to set up the example here, I'm going to have to kind of summarize a bit of American history, and you'll kind of understand here in a minute why I'm doing this, but it's important to have the full context here to understand the example I'm about to point to. Now, if you're familiar at all with the history of the United States, the U.S., kind of declared independence and became a separate nation, basically broke away from being a British colony in the late 1700s. That's when the U.S. officially became a nation. Now, for the first about 100 years of the existence of the U.S., slavery was actually legal in the United States. That was a common practice throughout many of the states of the U.S. And unfortunately, a lot of people don't know this to our current history because it's so much of it is focused on a racial narrative. But there was numerous racial groups that were, victims of slavery. There were, people of numerous, ethnic backgrounds that were slaves in the U.S. at the time that, that was legal. But it predominantly, tended to affect those of an African background. If you just look at it population-wise, that was the largest population that was affected by it. Well, in the 1800s, there was a civil war fought in the U.S. And this was like in the 1860s. And one of the things that came out of that was basically making slavery illegal. Now it was no longer legal to own another human being as property and to mistreat them like that. But particularly for those of an African American lineage background, this didn't end all the oppression that people of this racial group experienced in the U.S. For the next 100 years, again depending upon what area of the U.S. that you lived in, there was a lot of mistreatment and racial discrimination that took place even all the way up to even into the 1960s. I'm not saying that all of that is completely gone in every aspect, but again, as a nation as a whole, our laws oftentimes up until the 1960s explicitly discriminated against and kind of oppressed these individuals. Now, the reason I'm making this example is I want you to see the contrast between 200 years of slavery and direct racism and oppression and the damage that did as compared to 50 plus years of the welfare state that was instituted in the 1960s out of good intentions, out of an idea of we're doing something positive and good. Because, slavery and racial oppression, that's not done out of an intention of, well, we're trying to be nice to people. That's knowingly mistreating individuals. You may justify it, but no one does that out of, oh, we're trying to be loving and kind. What was instituted in the 1960s through the welfare programs were oftentimes done, again, out of the desire to be nice. But the results ultimately did the exact opposite. Because what I want you to see here is particularly when I mentioned kind of the welfare programs, prior to the 1960s, literally the laws in the U.S., for some of the welfare programs, like what was called Aid to Families with Dependent Children, is AFDC, literally, the laws were written where it excluded African Americans where they couldn't receive these benefits. And this, significantly changed in the 1960s, kind of with the civil rights movement. But then there was a major push to, to kind of go overboard with this. They literally had programs where they sent social workers, particularly into the large urban areas where there was a, a high African American population. And they would go door to door, basically trying to inform people of benefits that they could be aware of and trying to, you know, sign up as many people as possible. Well, the way these programs were designed, it unfortunately tended to encourage single parenthood and discourage work. Now, I can speak firsthand for that, and the reason I say that is in the 1990s, right after I got, you know, graduated from Ambassador College, I actually worked for the Texas Department of Human Services. I actually processed welfare claims for the AFDC program. That's now been completely restructured in more recent years. But, you know, in 1993, when I started working there, that program was still intact. And I would process claims for AFDC, for food stamps, and for the Medicaid program. And I got to see the culture that came about as a result of this. You know, and it was a very dysfunctional program because, again, oftentimes the way the rules were written, it discouraged, you know, work and oftentimes encouraged single parenthood. Now, what I want you to understand is if you look at statistics, you see a devastating effect that took place here. If you look at single parenthood statistics in the 1940s and 1950s in the U.S., among the African American population, there were typically, you know, single, you know, children born in, you know, into basically, you know, to single parents where mom and dad are not married, was typically between about 10 and 14% of, you know, of that population. That was about equal of what you would see in the white population. In fact, in the 1950s, if you look at it statistically, if you were a child born in the U.S. to a black family, you were slightly more likely to be born into a two-parent family than you were if you were born into a white family. Today, the results are dramatically the opposite. You know, today, if you're a child born into a black family, 70 to 75% is the chance that you'll be born into a single-parent family. In some larger urban areas, it's more like 90%. Now, to kind of share with you some more detail on this, you know, oftentimes the whole dynamics I just described here in the statistics oftentimes get, you know, kind of brushed aside with the term a legacy of slavery. In other words, people look back and say, oh, well, that's just from the, you know, the history of slavery and oppression that these people have faced, and that's what's the cause, this destruction of the family structure. But again, statistics don't match that. You know, because again, through 200 years of slavery and, you know, blatant racial discrimination, you know, again, even in the 1950s, the single parent rate was, you know, the illegitimacy rate was about 10 to 14%. Today, it's 75% or more. You know, the statistics don't match that narrative at all. And to kind of further back this up, I'd like to quote from an article that I pulled off the internet. This is from a site called nationalreview.com. The author is Dr. Thomas Sowell. And the article is a few years old. It's from May 5th, 2015. And what I'm going to read to you is kind of the second half of the article. In the first half of the article, he's kind of addressing the Black Lives Matter riots that took place in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014 and Baltimore, Maryland in 2015. And that was around the time that organization was really getting kicked off. This was, you know, long before the 2020 riots that we saw. They were, you know, burning down cities all over the nation. But he kind of addresses that in the first half of the article, and I'm going to pick up in the second half of the article because he's talking about how this legacy of slavery issue does not explain the issues that these, you know, communities are dealing with. And to pick up with the article, it says, quote, "The legacy of slavery argument is not just an excuse for inexcusable behavior in the ghettos. In a large sense, it is an evasion of responsibility for the disastrous consequences of the prevailing social vision of our times and the political policies based on that vision over the past half century. Anyone who is serious about evidence need only compare black communities as they evolved in the first 100 years after slavery with black communities as they evolved in the first 50 years after the explosive growth of the welfare state, beginning in the 1960s. You would be hard-pressed to find as many ghetto riots prior to the 1960s as have been seen just in the past year." And again, he's referring to 2014 to 15 in this context. "Much less in the 50 years since a wave of such riots swept across the country in 1965. We are told that such riots are a result of black poverty and white racism. But in fact, for those who still have some respect for facts, Black poverty was far worse, and white racism was far worse prior to 1960. But violent crime within black ghettos was far less. Murder rates among black males were going down, repeat, down, during the much lamented 1950s, while it went up after the much celebrated 1960s, reaching levels more than double what they had been before. Most black children were raised in two-parent families prior to the 1960s, but today the great majority of black children are raised in one-parent families. Such trends are not unique to blacks, nor even to the United States. The welfare state has led to remarkably similar trends among the white underclass in England over the same period. Just read Life at the Bottom by Theodore Dalrymple, a British physician who worked in a hospital in a white slum neighborhood. You cannot take any people of any color and exempt them from the requirements of civilization, including work, behavioral standards, personal responsibility, and all the other basic things that the clever intelligentsia disdain, without ruinous consequences to them and to the society at large. Non-judgmental subsidies of counterproductive lifestyles are treating people as if they were livestock, to be fed and tended by others in a welfare state, yet expecting them to develop as human beings have developed when facing the challenges of life themselves. One key fact that keeps getting ignored is that the poverty rate among black married couples has been in the single digits every year since 1994. Behavior matters and facts matter more than the prevailing social visions or political empires built on those visions. See, he's saying what he's pointing out here is that programs, you know, like the welfare system. And again, I'm not condemning, you know, welfare as a general practice. Realize, you know, God himself in the Bible establishes the third tithe system. What was it intended for? You know, for the widows, for the fatherless, you know, for those that needed help and assistance. God's not against that by any means. You know, what he's against is subsidizing bad behavior, because that's what this became. You know, the way these programs were promoted and the way the rules were written, it wound up, you know, basically discouraging work and encouraging single parenthood. And again, it all starts out with good intentions. And that's kind of the point I want you to see in this. You know, it was easy to look at this and say, oh, these are mistreated people. We should help them out. We should do good. And again, it's not a bad thing to want to help people, you know, who've been mistreated and had a hard time in life. That's a good thing to do. But we got to be careful how you do something like that, because you got to think about what's the long-term outcome involved, you know. And see, that's what happened here is there wasn't thought in terms of, okay, what's going to be the long-term effect of this result? Because it's kind of the opposite of the examples I was giving you before, where, you know, something that's very brutal and painful on the front end when you look at this and go, that's just awful, but the long-term outcome was a positive thing. Well, this is the opposite, where it looks very positive and looks like it's kind and loving on the front end, but you look at the long-term effects and go, well, this was a disaster. You know, this wound up hurting way more people than it helped. Because see, the biblical principle here that this is based upon is turned to 2 Thessalonians. Well, see here, Paul himself kind of sums up the biblical principle that ties to all of this. 2 Thessalonians. Chapter 3, in verse 6. But we command you, brethren, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you withdraw from every brother who walks disorderly, not according to the tradition you have received from us, which he received from us. Now, if we keep reading here, we'll understand what tradition he's talking about. For you yourselves know how you ought to follow us, for we were not disorderly among you, nor did we eat anyone's bread free of charge, but work with labor and toil night and day, that we may not be a burden to any of you, not because we do not have authority, but to make ourselves an example of how you should follow us. For even we were with you, we commanded you this: if anyone will not work, neither shall he eat. See, he's referring to subsidizing people who refuse to work, is what he's talking about. You know, in verse 11, for we hear that there are some who walk among you in a disorderly manner, not working at all, but are busybodies. Now those who are such, we command you, exhort through our Lord Jesus Christ, that they work in quietness and eat their own bread. But as for you, brethren, do not grow weary in doing good. For if anyone does not obey our word in this epistle, note that person and do not keep company with him, that he may be ashamed. Yet do not count him as an enemy, but admonish him as a brother. You see, oftentimes it's easy to look at a situation and say, well, you know, this person's doing without, you know, we need to help them. You know, we need to subsidize them and be kind and such. And again, if there's a legitimate need, that's definitely what we should do if we have the means to help others. But what he's saying is if you've got a person who refuses to work, you know, who just keeps making bad decisions and just keeps getting themselves, you know, in self-inflicted problems, you know, it's not like they were, you know, in a situation and circumstances beyond their control, put them in a rough situation and you're going to help them out. You know, that's a good thing we should always be willing to do. But if you've got someone who refuses to work, you know, who's just being lazy and refuses to take responsibility, he says, let them face the consequences, you know, because maybe if the consequences get painful enough, they'll re-examine their behavior, you know, and not want to continue on in the bad behavior, you know, that they've been following. See, that's the principle he's talking about. But see, it's easy at times to look at that and go, oh, but we need to be kind, we need to be nice and everything. And again, it makes people feel good on the front end, but you've got to think about what are the long-term ramifications here, you know, and are we creating more problems than we're solving? Because again, that's what happened with the example I gave of the welfare system. You know, it wasn't just helping people getting a climb out of oppression so they can have productive lives and such. What we wound up doing as a result of this is literally creating a welfare culture of entire communities. You know, and I actually experienced this firsthand. Again, as I mentioned, one of my first jobs out of Ambassador College, I worked for the Texas Department of Human Services. You know, and as a young kid who'd, you know, grown up in a, you know, a farming community in the South and then went to AC and then moved to Dallas, it was kind of a shock to my system to kind of see human nature at its ugliest. You know, because I would literally see circumstances where, you know, young girls were, you know, were coming in to apply for their welfare programs, and oftentimes the parents were with them, but I could watch the dynamics, and I could literally see there was a culture where it was like considered she's an adult now, it's a rite of passage, she has her own welfare, you know, case now with her own illegitimate children. And it's not looked at as, you know, we're trying to make the best of a bad situation. It was like, yeah, you're now into adulthood. You have your own welfare case, you know, under your own name and stuff. And I watched this going, this is nuts, you know. And you realize that it's gone beyond just trying to help people out of a rough situation. You've created a dysfunctional culture that encourages this, you know. And then the sins of the fathers are, you know, passed on to the third and fourth generation. You know, and then again, you go from a 10 to 14%, you know, illegitimacy rate to over a 70%. You know, the results were disaster. You know, so again, you always have to look at the long-term outcome. As I mentioned at the beginning of the sermon, this whole concept of understanding biblical love, and again, it's not about, you know, the warm, fuzzy feelings that we oftentimes associate love with. It's about, does it do good rather than does it feel good? And we've looked at a historical example, in other words, understanding how God operated in the past with ancient Israel, and you have to look through those eyes to properly understand it. Well, the same is true for our lives today. We're going to see, look at our, you know, how God works with us today and how we will work with mankind in the future. Because we know God's the same yesterday, today, and forever. He uses the same definition of love, you know, all the time. And that's important for us because oftentimes, sometimes people go into Christianity, you know, and they think, well, now as long as I obey God, well, he's going to protect me from all pain, you know, and everything's going to work out as long as I'm obeying and doing what I'm supposed to do, you know, and I'm a good little boy, a little girl, you know, and I obey and do what's right. Well, then everything's going to go smoothly for me. And then they get slapped with a trial later and realize, unfortunately, it doesn't work quite like that. Turn over to 1 Peter chapter 4. And we're going to see here... Now, the Bible tells us quite the opposite. Now, God is definitely very loving and cares for us, you know, and wants to, you know, to deliver us through whatever we have to go through. But he also specifically tells us that it is a normal expectation for a Christian that this is going to hurt. you know, this is going to be hard, it's going to be a struggle, and that you're required to face, you know, absolute oppression and persecution from Satan, and this is going to hurt, and you're going to struggle through it. You know, and he tells us, don't think it's unusual, because this is just how it works. This is how Christianity works. It's 1 Peter 4 and verse 12. Beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you as though some strange thing happened to you. In other words, this is not an if, this is a when. This is going to hurt. It is going to happen to you, and you're going to have to, you know, struggle your way through it. That's just simply how it works. You know, so if we go into this, you know, with this naive idea of, well, God's all about love and, you know, being kind and gentle, and everything's going to feel good, and as long as I obey, everything will be wonderful. You're going to get disillusioned, you know, when some brutal trial hits you and you have to struggle through it. And continue on to verse 13. But rejoice to the extent that you partake in Christ's sufferings, that when his glory is revealed, that you may be glad with exceeding joy. If you are reproached for the name of Christ, blessed are you. Now, we typically don't think of being reproached and persecuted as a blessing, do we? We think, no, make that go away. That's why the Bible looks at it differently, because it's about the long-term outcome. For the spirit of the glory of God rests upon you. On their part, he is blasphemed, but on your part, he is glorified. But let none of you suffer as a murderer, a thief, an evildoer, as a busybody in other people's matters. In other words, he's saying, don't bring your suffering upon yourself because you were stupid, you know, and refused to obey God, and you just insist on making bad decisions. That's not the suffering you want to face. You want to avoid that. But even if you do that, you're still going to have hard trials. It's still going to be a beating. Yet if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in this manner. For the time has come for judgment to begin at the house of God. And if it begins in the first, what shall be the end of those who obey the gospel of God? Now, if the righteous one is scarcely saved, where will the ungodly and the sinner appear? Therefore, let those who suffer according to the will of God commit their souls to him in doing good as to a faithful creator. In other words, he's directly telling us, if you sign up to be a Christian, it's going to hurt. This is going to be painful. You're going to have to endure through this. There's going to be times you're going to be facing very painful trials and thinking, man, I didn't know it was going to be this hard, you know, and you're going to be begging God to help to deliver you through it and give you the strength to get through it. That's how Christianity works. You know, in my lifetime in the Church of God, I've seen a number of people get disillusioned with God when, you know, some very brutal trial hits them, you know, and they just, you know, they're disillusioned with God and think, well, a loving God couldn't do this. You know, this just hurt too much, you know, and I just can't have anything to do with a God who would do this. Because again, they're looking at love from that definition of, does it feel good? You know, and that is not how God defines it. It's does it do good, not does it feel good? Because we always have to think again, what's going to be the ultimate outcome? Because again, you have to understand, he promises us all, if we're going to follow Christ, you know, and accept him as our Savior and pursue salvation, we're going to be persecuted. Again, it's not an if, it's a when. Turn over to 2 Timothy chapter 3. 2 Timothy chapter 3. In verse 12. Yes, and all who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. Notice there's not an asterisk next to this that says, oh, just the apostles, you know, just the prophets in the Old Testament, just a few people, you know, all the rest of you, as long as you're good boys and girls, you get to skip it all. That's not what it says. So it says everybody's going to face it. It's part of how the program works. Because again, to properly understand, again, the love of God and how he works with us, past, present, or future, we have to understand that biblical definition of love. Because again, it's not about, does it feel good? Is it pleasant and joyful, you know, for us while we're experiencing it? It's all about the long-term outcome. Because again, you have to understand, this is inherent to the very definition of love. Because what's the chapter in the Bible that we all think of when we think of defining love? Don't we always think of what's referred to as the love chapter, 1 Corinthians 13? Let's turn there and read a few scriptures here, and I want you to notice how enduring through suffering like this is kind of inherent to the very definition of love. It's 1 Corinthians 13. We'll start in verse 1. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I have become a sounding brass or a clanging cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, though I give my body to be burned, but have not love, it profits me nothing. But I notice the next several verses. Love suffers long and is kind. I've kind of asked this question for years. How do we develop the ability to suffer long and be kind if we don't first have to suffer long? You know, wouldn't that be a requirement for how we would develop that ability? You know, I mean, it's inherently telling us that, you know, suffering is a part of this, and learning how to endure through it is part of developing the very character of God. Continuing on in verse 4, love does not envy. Love does not parade itself, is not puffed up. Love does not behave rudely, does not seek his own, is not provoked, thinks no evil, does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Now, let me read to you the definition of the Greek word translated into English there as endures, when it says endures all things. It's transliterated into English as hupomeno. It's H-U-P-O-M-E-N-O. It's Strong's number 5278. And the definition I'm going to give you is from the Complete Word Study Dictionary of the New Testament by Spyros Sahaitis. He defines it as, quote, to remain under, i.e. to persevere, endure, sustain, bear up under, suffer, as a load of miseries, adversities, persecutions, or provocations with faith. In other words, the very definition of godly love is we're going to suffer through it with a good attitude, you know, and we're going to have the character of God even when we're going through it. You know, it's not this idea that, well, God just wants everything to be comfortable and loving and warm and fuzzy because that's what people need. You know, that's not how he defines it. Because again, his whole focus is, and again, not on how it feels for us today, but the ultimate outcome. You know, as I've mentioned in several sermons recently, you know, if you look at the book of Job, again, that's kind of one of the most thorough coverings in the Bible of the subject of suffering. You know, and it tells us from the very beginning of the story, you know, God himself repeatedly, you know, describes Job as a blameless and upright man who fears God and shuns evil. Makes it painfully obvious he's not putting this guy through this. You know, this isn't his just desserts, you might say, for being this derelict and evil sinner. He's saying, no, he literally goes to Satan and says, this is my poster child. You know, have you noticed my servant Job, what a great guy he is? You know, but then he turns around and has Satan go after him. And then he takes basically lets, you know, loose the most evil being in all of the universe, going after Job and says, you can do anything to my hero here, just don't kill him. You know, imagine how brutal this is. But why does he do this? Again, because of the end he has in mind. It's not because this is a pleasant experience for anybody. Again, if you read through the book of Job, he is not enjoying this experience. He thinks it's the most awful nightmare he's ever experienced in his life. You know, and if we read through it, we go, yeah, I wouldn't want to sign up for that. That sounds like an awful nightmare. Why does he do it? He's focused on the end. Turn to James chapter 5. James chapter 5. In verse 10, my brethren, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord as an example of suffering and patience. And notice who's specifically referenced in verse 11. Indeed, we count them blessed who endure. You have heard of the perseverance of Job and seen the end intended by the Lord, that the Lord is very compassionate and merciful. It was all about how the movie ended. It was all about testing Job, and basically developing his character, his loyalty. Because even as righteous of a guy as Job is, what does he say at the end? I've heard of you with the hearing of my ears, but now I get it. I have a deeper understanding of you and your way and your justice than I did before. And God gave him a fantastic rating to start with, but he starts off going, oh, now I understood things I would have never understood if you had not put me through this ugly experience. He gained so much more, but also think, again, it's much more than just what Job himself learned. This was all because, Job said, I wish my words were written in a book, and they were preserved forever. Well, they were written in stone. He said, well, they were. They were preserved in the Bible for us. Millions of people have read them since then. If you think again, the total positive outcome that came out of this, that's what God was focused on. Was all the good he could accomplish. It wasn't because, focusing on a feel-good experience out front, because there was nothing feel-good about this experience. It was brutal, it was ugly, and it was a nightmare no one would want to live through. In their wildest dreams, they would never want to have to go through that. I certainly wouldn't. But again, you look at this and go, God's definition of love is very different from ours. Because again, we oftentimes look at this again through these carnal, physical, human eyes and think, well, love is what makes people feel good out front. Because again, as I mentioned here, we've looked at examples historically. We look at ancient Israel, how God worked with them. We look at how God works with us today. Well, he's consistent. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. He's going to work with the rest of mankind the exact same way. And oftentimes I've found as I explained at the feast, I started realizing about 13 years ago that something was wrong. And what I mean by that is from childhood, I was taught a scenario where the majority of mankind just has a comfortable, easy slide in the kingdom of God. They don't have to, face much tribulation. They don't have to endure to the end. They don't have to overcome the persecution that we just, we read there in 2 Timothy that everybody who follows Christ is going to have. So somehow they're going to skip all of that. And when I would point out oftentimes to people okay, this idea, I understand the appeal to it because I thought it sounded great to me too. But when I start looking at the New Testament and going, this doesn't match anything the New Testament says. What I found was the counter argument is people will go, oh, but God's love, he wouldn't put those people through suffering. He wants everything to be warm and fuzzy and positive. And I'm going, that's not what he did with ancient Israel. That's not what he's doing with us today. None of this is consistent. And I would always just get these emotional arguments, that would come back. And I read this quote at the feast and in my sermon I gave last Sabbath. I'm filming this a week or two ahead of when you guys are going to see this. I'm actually filming this the Sabbath after the feast. But the quote I want to read, I read this in my sermon at the end of the feast, is from Dr. Thomas Sowell. He says, the reason so many people misunderstand so many issues is not that these issues are so complex, but that people do not want a factual or analytical explanation that leaves them emotionally unsatisfied. And see, what I found over years is that's what the roadblock for people that will even admit that, God conquered the promised land and did these, very brutal acts for and ultimately because of the outcome, because it would end well. And they'll agree that, God puts us through harsh trials today, because he's focused on the long-term outcome. And I'd say, well, he's going to do that the same thing with everybody else. Oh, no, that wouldn't be loving. Okay, is it not loving when he does that with us today then? Okay, we got to be consistent. So again, if we understand the biblical definition of love, then it's not hard at all to understand how God works with us in the future. Because as I explained in one of my sermons during the feast this year, if we look at the millennium, it's this wonderful picture, where there's no war, as Isaiah 2 tells us, swords into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks, they don't learn war anymore and everything's peaceable. We have Isaiah 35, all the health problems are healed and everybody's healthy. We have abundant resources with the plowman overcoming the reaper, and it's all just this wonderful utopia. And again, that's definitely a part of God's plan. He tells us that in graphic detail. But we ask, in our minds, that's what love is. Well, that's just making everything wonderful. And we think, well, would God then turn around and let Satan loose again and mess that up? Yes, that's what the Bible tells us. And again, the reason why is not hard to understand. It's the same reason he puts us through those trials for the exact same purposes. So again, this understanding love is key to understanding how God works historically with us today and in the future. So let's turn over to Revelation 20. Let's just briefly look at the future. And I covered this at the feast, but we'll start here in Revelation 20 and verse 1. This is actually describing the binding of Satan. It says, "And then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. And he laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years, and cast him to the bottomless pit, and shut him up, and set a seal upon him, so that he should deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years were finished." Now, in my history in the Church of God, which I've mentioned many times, it's been my entire life, you know, we love to focus on that because, like, wow, look at all the problems that that's going to make go away. We get the bad guy and all of his posse and lock him up, you know, whether they can't affect mankind. That's just going to make things so much better, and it will. And we love to focus on that, but we have trouble with the next sentence. "But after these things, he must be released for a little while." Well, why would God set the bad guy back out to mess everything up? You know, for the same reason he allows Satan to affect us today. Because again, not because it feels good, but because it does good. Because we have to overcome those temptations and suffer, you know, endure through those trials to build that character of God, that agape love in us, you know, so that we can be in his kingdom. You know, it's the process of how godly character is developed. So you just look down at verse 7. This is where the story picks up after the millennium. "Now when the 1,000 years have expired, Satan will be released from his prison. He will go out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle those who are in the numbers of the sea." So in other words, he's basically going to stir up a war. You know, this is the exact opposite of Isaiah 2. You know, they don't learn war anymore. Well, obviously that applies to the millennium. You know, as one person asked me towards the end of the feast, well, how do you reconcile these two scriptures? I said, well, they both have to be true. You know, Isaiah 2 is true, and this is true as well. Isaiah 2 is obviously specifically referring to the millennium. You know, it's obvious that there's not ever a war again in human existence because we have it described here that we know that there is. You know, so obviously that applies to the millennium. But as I mentioned also at the feast, if you put Matthew 25 together with this, what we see is all of these perfect things that we see in the millennium obviously go away during the 8th day period. So let's just briefly turn over to Matthew 25. We talked about this at the feast, but I'll just cover this again for any who may not have heard that sermon. So Matthew 25. Start in verse 31. Now, what we're going to see here is basically the criteria that Christ uses when he says he's separating the sheep from the goats. And again, if we just read the context and take it for exactly what it says, this is obviously, I mean, the concepts obviously apply to the first reach, and we're obviously judged by the same criteria. But what he's specifically describing here is the judgment of the rest of mankind. Verse 31, "And when the Son of Man comes in his glory, and all the holy angels with him, and he will sit on the throne of his glory, and all the nations will be gathered before him. And he will separate them one from another as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats." Notice, Christ has returned. You know, he's now on earth here, and he's judging all of mankind. So again, this isn't the first fruits that he's specifically addressing here. Now, obviously, the same concepts apply, you know, to the first fruits. Don't get me wrong; it's, you know, the conceptually the same criteria applies to us, you know. But again, what is he specifically talking about here? He's specifically talking about judging the rest of mankind. In verse 33, "And he will set the sheep on his right hand, but the goats on the left. And the king will come to those in his right hand, 'Come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. And I was a stranger, and you took me in. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me.' Then the righteous will answer him, saying, 'Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? And when did we see you a stranger and take you in or naked and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and come to you? And the king will answer and say to them, assuredly, I say to you, as much as you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me. Then he will say to those on the left hand, depart from me, you cursed, into the everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry and you gave me no food. I was thirsty and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger and you did not take me in. Naked and you did not clothe me. Sick and in prison and you did not visit me. Then you will answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or a sick or in prison and did not minister you? And he will answer them, saying, assuredly, I say to you, as much as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. And these will go into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. Now, the point I want you to notice in all of this is for any of this criteria to make any sense, obviously, when Satan gets released, during the eighth day period, as I covered it at the feast, what's going to happen here is he's going to make that period of time, once he had a chance to really work on mankind and start tempting them to start rebelling again, he's going to create an environment rather similar to our world today, where there's wars, there's suffering, there's people doing without resources, there's sickness, all of this is going to take place. And again, oftentimes people scratch their head, but that wouldn't be loving. Okay, is it loving when God puts us all through that today to build his character in us? Of course it is. Because again, it's not about does it feel good? It's not is it a pleasant thing to go through? It's again, what is God ultimately accomplishing with it? It's always about does it do good? It's about how the movie ends. Because again, oftentimes I find people struggle with this subject because they're wearing what I like to refer to as an emotional blindfold. Because again, if you're looking at the Bible and God, God, whether you're looking historically, us today, or in the future, if you're defining love from the question, does it feel good, then your brain's going to automatically reject something that doesn't match that view. And it literally becomes an emotional blindfold where someone can show you a stack of scriptures that all agree and all say the same thing, and you'll just want to reject it. But that's not love. As one person put it to me, there's actually a long-term minister in the Church of God, and I quoted this at the feast. I was talking about this very concept with him. And he looked at me and he said, this is so negative, God's way is positive. In other words, God's way feels good. It's based on the question, does it feel good? No, it's not. God's way is based on the question, does it do good? That's how God defines love. Because rather than if we're going to understand God's very nature, how he worked with mankind in the past, how he works with us today, how he'll work with mankind in the future, we have to understand his mind, his character. And again, that is summed up by the term agape love, as 1 Corinthians tells us, as 1 John 4 tells us. Agape love defines God's character. And brethren, as we go forward from this day, let's understand, when we look at the subject of love, it's not about whether it feels good to our emotions, whether it feels good on the front end. It's about what it ultimately accomplishes. It's about how the movie ends. So when you decide whether something is loving from a biblical perspective, don't ask the question, does it feel good to my emotions? Ask the question, does it do good in the long run?